This hour of programming on 98.7 WFMT is made possible in part by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Victoria Lautman's guest today is Ann Packer, whose book, Songs Without Words, will be the topic of discussion. We go now to the stage of the Looking Glass Theater. Here is Victoria Lautman.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. And welcome to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. We are here live at Looking Glass Theater in our fourth season. I want to remind you that we are selling books after this by Seminary Co-op, and you can ask questions in the last 15 minutes of the show. And I also want to thank, again, the folks from MavenChronicles.com for underwriting this season and last season of Writers on the Record. They are fantastic. I hope that you will all come to see the Looking Glass Theater production of Hephaestus when it opens in January, and I'll tell you more about that in January. Anyway, now, most of you will remember back in 2002, it seemed as though the dive from Clausen's Pier was pretty much everywhere. You couldn't pick up a newspaper or a magazine without seeing a glowing review about this book. It turned up on pretty much every book club list that entire year and the one after it. And people would corner you at parties and badger you about whether you'd read it, and if you hadn't, why didn't you? And then if you had read it, they would badger you about how you felt about the characters and whether you felt they were acting morally or not. You know, which side were you on? And it seemed at that moment that Ann Packer, at age 43, had achieved something that was really rare and coveted. She had created a runaway best-selling hit book in her debut novel. People seemed to be absolutely transfixed by the story of love and loyalty and friendship and loss. That book was 10 years and 9 drafts in the making. So we only had to wait 5 years for the second book, and it was really lovely that Ann Packer wrote a little bit faster this time. It's Song Without Words, and I'm thrilled to welcome Ann Packer to Writers on the Record. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
But, you know, it must have kind of bugged you, because people were acting at the time as though you'd sort of dropped onto the planet Earth without any preamble, when, in fact, you had written a group of short stories. You've been published in The New Yorker, and in 1994, your Mendocino and Other Stories came out. To fanfare, I mean, it wasn't exactly like the dive from Clausen's Pier, but did that ever just annoy you, that people acted like, wow, who's this 42-year-old, and where'd she come from? 43, excuse me.
No, it was just very nice to get such a positive welcome for my first novel. And Mendocino and Other Stories, when it was published, was published quietly, and it was a collection of stories which unfortunately don't get read as much as novels do in this country, despite there being just a wonderful form and despite the fact that we have practitioners of the short story who are, I think, among the best writers working in America today.
People like to dig into a novel.
Yeah, you'd like to go in and sit down and stay for a while. So I feel the same way. I love reading novels.
Well, this book, Songs Without Words, it's interesting, and people have pointed this out, that there are some leitmotifs from the dive from Clausen's Pier. But if you go back and actually look at even the first story, the short story for which the book was named, Mendocino, there are very similar themes in all of these stories of some kind of loss and love and friendship. And I wonder if you see this kind of, when you sat down to actually write Songs Without Words, did you think about those themes particularly, or did you enter the book from the standpoint of a particular character or scenario?
It all kind of happens at once. I don't sort of page through the possible themes and think, okay, loss, yeah, check, let's do that again. Obligation, duty, betrayal, yeah, I like all those. I think I'll bring those along again. They're just there in my mind. They're in my imagination. And the way I think about the world and the people I know is often sort of based on questions of moral behavior and how it is that we both live up to other people's expectations and don't, and also live up to our own expectations and don't. So that's sort of the area that I'm working all the time. With the book, to actually get going, yes, I begin with characters.
This book is set, coincidentally, at a time in California that is pretty much now, right now, the days leading up to Thanksgiving, in a very emotionally fraught for all people, and particularly for families. That is when it takes place. But the book begins with a prologue from 30 years earlier, basically, 1976. So, and I thought maybe, why don't you start with that, and then we can talk about some of the characters that you introduce in that prologue.
Sure. This is the very opening of the novel. And as you said, it's 1976. Each evening, the streetlights came on at dusk, and the view out the window changed from barely glowing kitchens and TV rooms to the houses that contained them and to the trees that sheltered the houses. It seemed to Sarah Beth that for a little while there was a kind of balance out there, an equilibrium. But then, quickly, darkness came down from the sky, and soon the lit rooms returned to prominence, and finally everything else was black, and the world seemed limited to a few bright windows on a street in Palo Alto. She was at her desk now, doing homework, at John Castleberry's desk, which, like his room, was available for her to use this year because he was away at college. Across the hall, Liz was working too. The first couple weeks of Sarah Beth's living here, they had done their homework together at the dining room table, as they so often had in the past, when Sarah Beth lived in her own house across the street. But doing homework together night after night was different from hooking up from time to time, for company or help, and now they studied separately. Out in the hall, Mrs. Castleberry was talking to Liz's younger brother, Steve, who'd started junior high this year. "Just some math," Sarah Beth heard him say. "I'm on top of it." "I know you are," Mrs. Castleberry said, "but don't forget to get on top of those dirty clothes we talked about, too." "I know," he said, and though he sounded impatient with her, Sarah Beth knew Mrs. Castleberry would just smile her smile, maybe chuckle as she continued on her way. Mrs. Castleberry was so calm. Her footsteps approached, and she came into view, slowing to wave at Sarah Beth. Sarah Beth waved back. Even this late in the evening, Mrs. Castleberry's hair was neatly brushed back from her forehead and held in place by a wide headband. Liz had the same thick, slightly wavy hair. Sarah Beth's hair was curly and would not be contained. Mrs. Castleberry's heels tap-tapped their way down the stairs and then changed sounds slightly as she headed for the kitchen. The dishwasher started, and the faint noise of the water joined the muffled sounds coming from the TV show Mr. Castleberry was watching in the den. It was a special about NASA. At dinner, he'd suggested they all join him for it, and Liz and Steve had nodded solemnly, saying, "Sure thing, Dad. Wouldn't miss it, Dad," and then broken into laughter. "How about you?" he'd asked Sarah Beth. And while she was trying to figure out if he was teasing and how to respond, Liz said, "No torturing of guests, Dad." And that was that. He watched TV almost every night. So unlike Sarah Beth's father, who as far as she could remember had never in her entire life watched any TV at all. When he was home, and not somehow occupied with her mother, assuring her that dinner had been fine, more than fine, good, or saying that while he did like the new painting she'd bought, it was perhaps a little on the expensive side, or asking her to slow down and take a deep breath before continuing a story. Times when he wasn't busy with her mother, he cleared off his desk and painstakingly took apart and repaired old and broken radios, telephones, stereos, donating them to the Goodwill once he had them working again. Even last year, with Sarah Beth's mother gone, he'd never tried TV for relaxation, for the solace of not thinking. Instead, he'd continued bringing out appliances, letting them sit on his desk for days at a time, but only ever looking at them, or poking idly with his special tweezers, no real intention in mind. When Sarah Beth helped him pack up the house in August, there were boxes and boxes of old machines for the dump. Liz had put a record on. Her door was closed, but the album was so familiar, Sarah Beth didn't really need to hear it to know what it was. The Eagles, One of These Nights. Lion Eyes was starting, and Sarah Beth was tempted to wait for the refrain, "You can't hide your lion eyes," and then stick her head into Liz's room and say, "That is so true." It was a guaranteed crack-up. Bill Cuthbert had said it to Liz one evening in 10th grade when she was at his house working on a lab report. He gave her a meaningful look as he spoke, as if the Eagles were singing about a truth he'd had to learn the hard way. Sarah Beth remembered Liz telling her about it the next day as they rode their bikes to school, Liz's hair whipping behind her, her face full of glee. Tired of the physics problems she'd been working on, she moved to the bed and opened Swan's Way, the English translation she'd gotten from the library, without Monsieur's permission, though he hadn't explicitly forbidden it. "Sarah Beth," he had said, "c'est bien d'aimer Proust, mais il n'est pas lui-même en anglais." It's good to like Proust, but he is not himself in English. Of course he wasn't, but she couldn't help herself. And she was reading the French, too, just not as quickly. Monsieur looked the other way for her sometimes, which was sort of nice and sort of embarrassing. Even as she allowed herself to take advantage of it, she longed for next year, for the anonymity of college, when she would no longer be the girl whose mother had committed suicide. She would always be that girl at Palo Alto High School.
Ann Pack, a reading from her new book, Songs Without Words. The idea of suicide is a leitmotif in this book, and it really is the catalyst that sets the story in motion. We've gone back to this relationship that forms between Sarah Beth and Liz. They were neighbors. Then they became something more than good friends when, if we know now, Sarah Beth has to move in with the Castleberries. And then the book unfolds 30 or so years later when they're both adults, and they have very divergent lives. Liz is married and with two children, and actually in a family that sounds very much like the one that you're just describing that she grew up in. She has two kids, a teenage daughter and a son. And Liz, I mean, Sarah Beth grows up to be kind of not quite a participant in her own life. She has a very unusual career. She sort of has cobbled it together from various things. And I was curious first about that, like how you decide, well, Sarah Beth is going to actually be an observer, almost a voyeur in life. And in fact, her career of like house fluffer, she is a stager for people who are about to sell houses. And then she makes lampshades on the side. These are both sort of, it's like a voyeuristic, odd sideline sort of career.
Yeah, and then the third thing is that she reads aloud to the blind. I wanted her to be someone who was scraping by in a certain way, and financially she's got to do all these different things to try to make ends meet. Emotionally, she's scraping by. She's never managed to marry, has had a series of affairs, most recently with a married man, with, you know, the expected disastrous results. And I wanted there to be that very sharp contrast between where her life had taken her and where Liz's life had taken her.
And yet the two of them have maintained this friendship for all that time, and it's really the nature of that friendship that the book focuses on, with all of these other relationships on the side, that there's this intensity and love and history there, but that there's a sense that the ground that we're walking on is never really all that solid, and that one thing can happen in anybody's life, and you can spin into a totally different mode.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if I think back on, as we were talking about earlier, the sort of themes of my work, the theme of the unexpected, the terrible unexpected happening, and then the aftermath of that, and how we live with having gone through something unfathomable really interests me. So on the one hand, Sarah Beth's loss of her mother to suicide is the sort of deep background of tragedy survived and its long after effects. And then in the present, Liz's teenage daughter, Lauren, who's 15 years old, as the novel opens, is spiraling downward into a serious depression. And that brings about the present day catalyst for the challenge to Liz and Sarah Beth's friendship.
Now, are we allowed to talk about that, or do you consider that blowing the plot line?
Oh, I think we can talk about it, as long as we don't go too far.
Okay. Well, maybe
I should be more specific,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You go a little further then.
Lauren, this 15-year-old, becomes increasingly depressed and ultimately makes an attempt on her own life and winds up in a psychiatric hospital. She does not succeed in killing herself, but obviously she's very ill, and that illness affects her parents individually. It affects their marriage. It affects her. The book gets inside her head as well. And then in a very dramatic and surprising way, it affects her mother's relationship with Sarah Beth, who's, you know, sort of been a part of the family all along.
You know, some of the most touching moments are really when we are experiencing what Lauren, the teenage daughter, is going through. And, I mean, we have a largely female audience here, and there are some men. So, actually, it's very illuminating, I think, to men to hear that teenage girls, like, what goes on in their head, particularly around boys, and something as simple as, you know, how this guy is looking at you across the room. Yes, we all can remember those moments from when we're 14, 15, 16 years old. And it's just, obviously, you're still in touch with the girl in you that experienced that too. And I wondered about, you know, writing that character, who was a very different character for you to have to give those kinds of words and personality traits to.
You know, it's interesting. When I look back on the writing process for this novel, it's the character of Lauren who was easiest for me, really. Sometimes, as with Liz's husband, Brody, I really have to attack the question of who this person is and what their voice sounds like, what they're doing in life, how they relate to other people. Lauren just was there from the beginning. And I think, you know, I think it has a lot to do with memory for me of adolescence. I have a 15-year-old daughter myself, but she was not much help because she was 10 when I started the book. So it's turning out that, you know, some of what I imagined about teenage life is still going on all these years after my own. But it really, I think it has most to do with memory.
I think for parents reading this book too, there's a certain inherent, like everybody's going to see these characters and take away something very specific, I think, in their own life and relate to them in a way that they might have very much in The Dive from Clawson's Pier. And for Liz, whose whole kind of, you know, reason for being is to be a good parent and a good mother, a good housewife. She's not working. You know, her whole life is revolving around these kids. And so when it appears that a kid is unhappy, and yes, there were cries for help that she overlooked, she kind of wasn't really paying close attention to what was going on, it completely makes her reexamine her own success pretty much as a human being.
It's a huge assault on her sense of competence as a mother. And the fact that there were these hints makes it all the more excruciating. She knows something's wrong with Lauren. I wouldn't say that she's not paying attention. I would say that the terror of the truth feeds her ability to deny how serious things really are. There's a moment before Lauren's suicide attempt when she comes home with a bad grade on a paper she's written, and she's really distraught over it. And Liz thinks, oh, that's it. Okay, thank goodness. Now I can sort of stop worrying. This is just about how scared she is about bad grades this year. She's having trouble academically. She's never had it before. Now I understand why my child is suffering. And of course, you know, this is a sort of tragically successful way of not looking at the real problem. And, you know, the consequences of not seeing it are that the depression continues and worsens, and then Lauren does what she does.
The scenes that you write with Lauren inside this sort of child psychiatric unit were really compelling. I've never been in one. When I was in high school, there were kids who spent some time there, and actually almost became a badge of, I hate to think this back in the 70s, but it was a badge of a certain amount of, like, I don't know, pride almost, like, or coolness. And yeah. Then Lauren is really upset when she comes out, like, oh, my God, how can we keep this from everybody? She's very worried about it. But I know that in your acknowledgments you thank people who helped you specifically with that aspect of it. But how did you go about sort of coming up with this particular group of kids and their ailments and how they're treated? And
The other kids in the psych ward came to me. Those were imaginative projects that also were really pretty easy. I don't know why. Partly it was that I wasn't going to be getting very deeply inside any of those kids. And from the research I did, which was essentially talking to adolescent psychiatrists who had experience with inpatient work, I got a sense of the kinds of illnesses that the different kids would be likely to be suffering from.
Part of that made me think of just, and I know reviewers have said this about your earlier book too, that the layer of detail that you build up, you know, every book can have certain sort of props that make you think of the characters and the place and the setting in a certain way. But it's because of the layer of detail that you have and your observation. It's not just, you know, Liz went to get a slice of bread. She gets Holla, she takes it out of the package, she slices it to a certain thickness. Everything has, like, at least four pieces of description to every part of it that collectively add up to, it seems absolutely real. These characters are people we have practically recognized. And I was wondering about that process, too, that do you write it like that? Do you go back and think, well, I kind of need to pad this one. I only had one adjective, so I need a couple more.
I write it that way. I mean, I think for me what I'm most interested in doing is representing the way consciousness happens to a character in a day or a week or a life. You know, what being in that person's mind is like for that person. And I can't make that real without setting the person into a real world. So that if the bread isn't specified, then the thoughts sort of they have an abstract quality they don't relate to character enough, and so the movement through the physical world and then the characters moving through their own mental worlds and then coming together with other characters who have these other complex mental worlds. It's all of a piece.
God, no wonder it took you 5 years. Gee whiz. Well, which is why when we really enter Sarah Beth's world, and Sarah Beth and Lauren really have this almost parallel thing going on. They are just full of self-loathing and at different edges of their life. I mean, it seems as though Sarah Beth wasn't experiencing that early on when she could have, when her mother kills herself and she's entered this other world. But she does experience it in her 40s. And when she looks around and, you know, she's really got nothing. She is very isolated, you know, spies on her neighbors, has very few friendships. And at one point, you know, has trouble getting out of it. She's a classic depressive person. And yet, you want to kind of hit her. She refuses to go to a therapist. At one point, she makes a pile of very specific possessions in the center of her living room and thinks, this is what my life adds up to. And you just think, you know, why aren't you in the psych ward with a slit wrist? You know, you obviously care about her so much and have gotten this absolutely real character. And yet, she doesn't exactly get bailed out at the end. She gets, you know, her friendship maybe gets stabilized, but Sarah Beth, who is who she's going to be.
Yeah, it's important to me to not sugarcoat an ending or not put the characters at a place of, if the problem is a breach in a relationship, at a place of reconciliation that is not proportionate to what's gone on before. I think that as a writer, you know, the question of whether or not the characters are likable is really less important than whether or not they're real and believable. And for me, the job with someone like Sarah Beth, who I know, you know, it's interesting that there was a split in among readers of The Dive from Clausen's Pier about did they or didn't they approve of the choices that the main character made or approve of her. And I did hear, you know, I just wanted to slap her. I think with this book, there's a little bit more of a division between two camps, a sort of a Sarah Beth camp, and, oh, I felt so sympathetic. And then there's the Liz camp who were much less patient with Sarah Beth. But I wanted to just basically enable the reader to understand both characters and also to believe that in any given moment they were behaving in the only way that they could.
Did you always have a clear-cut end to it? Did you ever just want to, like, push her off a cliff? Did you know how it was going to end?
I had a sense of where the characters would be in relation to each other. That I refined that over the course of, you know, the five or six drafts that I did of the book. I didn't want to, again, to have them sailing off into the sunset together. But I also really, for me, there's, to have some kind of hope is very important. Realistic hope, I guess, is the phrase I would use.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and that cliff that I mentioned, there is a cliff in the book, which we'll come back and do a little reading about in a little while. You've been listening to Ann Packer talking about her new book, Songs Without Words, here on Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman. Thank you.
You're listening to 98.7 WFMT Chicago and to Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, a series featuring conversations with noteworthy authors who've published recent works of fiction or nonfiction. This local broadcast is made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere, and by Seminary Co-op Bookstores. In 1961, Seminary Co-op Bookstore was founded by 17 book lovers who invested $10 each. Now this consumer-owned bookstore is three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. The flagship store at 5757 South University Avenue carries about 200,000 titles and is widely regarded as one of the world's best academic bookstores. 57th Street Books at 1301 East 57th Street is a neighborhood bookstore carrying a wide selection of general interest titles in a unique space perfect for browsing. And the Newbery Library's bookshop at 60 West Walton specializes in genealogy, cartography, music, history, cards, gifts, and more in a beautiful landmark setting. The Seminary Co-op Bookstore's passion and experience have appealed to readers throughout the world. All their branches offer 10% member discounts, worldwide shipping, special order services, as well as special author events. Visit the Seminary Co-op Bookstores today. Call 800-777-1456 toll-free or look up semcoop.com. This hour of programming on 98.7 WFMT is made possible in part by the Seminary Co-op Bookstores, three Chicago bookstores with one world-class reputation. Each month, the featured author of Writers on the Record will be the subject of a brief Q&A written by Victoria Lautman for Chicago Magazine. Both the magazine and 98.7 WFMT will announce upcoming interviews, which take place Sundays at noon at Looking Glass Theater. Our next broadcast of Writers on the Record takes place Sunday, January 13th, when Victoria Lautman talks with Michael Lowenthal about his book, Charity Girl, If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. We return now to Chicago's Looking Glass Theater and our live broadcast of Writers on the Record. Today, Victoria Lautman has been discussing the book Songs Without Words with its author, Ann Packer.
Okay, we're back with Ann Packer talking about her latest novel, Songs Without Words. But while I've got you on the line, I would like to remind you that there is no Writers on the Record in December. But we will be back January 13th with Michael Lowenthal, and then Russell Banks in February, Richard Price in March, Elizabeth Strout in April. We've got a great fourth season planned. But right now we're talking to Ann Packer about her second novel and third book, Songs Without Words. She, of course, wrote The Dive from Clausen's Pier in 2002. And if you've never read her collection of short stories, Mendocino and Other Stories, 1994, it's a really great book. And you will actually see many parallel themes. In fact, the first story in Mendocino begins with two siblings talking about the suicide of a parent. And in this book, even, at one point, Sarah Beth, who is, you know, of course, Lauren's attempted suicide affects Sarah Beth in a way that it wouldn't just affect everybody, since Sarah Beth has had to grow up with the specter of being the daughter of a suicide. And she even mentions at some point that she had a friend in her 30s whose father had committed suicide. So it is a kind of thing that permeates everybody in the book. And one of the effects of this, I mean, we realize that the marriage, the relationship between Brody, the dad, and Liz, the mom, and the two kids, they seem like this perfect American family, and everybody's functioning, and yes, there's things under the surface. And actually, it turns out there's a lot more under the surface than we realize, and it's thrown into kind of harsh, raking light by Lauren's crisis. And there's even a point, and very soon after she attempts the suicide, that that Brody's sitting there looking at his wife thinking, I hate you, I hate your guts. Now, that was like 4 pages earlier, they were thinking about hot sex that night. So the idea that a relationship can suddenly, all these relationships can change on a dime is true but terrifying.
Yeah, and I think the reason they can is that so much negative emotion goes unexpressed and therefore builds, and of course we all know this, until when it finally has to be expressed, it's explosive. So, you know, the sort of everyday resentments of a marriage might just be simmering for a long, long time, and then something as catastrophic as your child trying to kill herself will both set both parties on edge so that anything is going to set them off. And also, you know, push some of the simmering things to a boil.
When Lauren finally gets out of the psych ward, everything is so destabilized. Nobody knows how to treat her. She doesn't know how to act. It's like there's a whole new terra incognita that has to be negotiated with everybody. And there's a scene in the book where the family decides, or Brody, the dad, decides, okay, we're all going out. Nobody wants to have this outing. Things are kind of not really normal with anybody. But they decide to go to the beach. Is this an important scene for you?
It is. It's a moment when things in the family are at a point where they have to move in some direction. And I wanted to show both that sort of openness of where it would go and then a sense of how they might move forward in a healthy or positive way.
All right.
So they, as you said, Lauren is just out of the psych ward, and Brody has decided that they'll go to the beach. They took their usual access road to their usual parking area. Outside the van, the wind was ferocious. They ducked their heads, rounded their shoulders, shoved their hands into their sweatshirt pockets. At the path, Joe took the lead. Lauren was in the rear, just behind her dad. The water was vast and dark, edged by a long, wide stretch of beach. They were at the top of a cliff, and Joe picked his way through beach grass and shrubs until he came to a steep, narrow trail down to the sand. Her mom was afraid of heights, or no, of falling. Without a look back, Joe skipped his way down, but her mom only glanced back over her shoulder and then hesitantly took a single step. She waited, then brought the other foot after her and stopped. Help her, Lauren thought, but her dad didn't move. Again, her mom moved one foot, and then, very slowly, the other. There was a turn in the trail now, and Lauren couldn't see the angle of descent, but her mom's stillness told her it was getting steeper. Her dad put his hands on his hips. Her mom stepped down again, but now she slipped a little and gasped, and she reached a quick hand to the ground to steady herself. Ow, she exclaimed, and she pulled the hand right back and looked at it, then clapped her palm against her jeans and stared straight ahead. Dad, Lauren said in a low voice. He turned. Help her. She's okay. Lauren couldn't stand it. She stepped past him and said, Want a hand? I can go ahead of you. You can hold my shoulder. Just go on down, her dad said in a nice enough voice, but it was like that was it. No choices. Lauren had to go. Her mom smiled at her. It's okay. And Lauren shrugged and made her way down. From the beach, she looked back up. Her dad was in front of her mom now, her mom's hand on her dad's shoulder. Joe came up. What are they doing? They're coming, Lauren said. With the toe of his sneaker, he lifted a piece of seaweed and flung it away. He looked straight at her with a question he'd never ask, and she felt her face warm and looked up again. Her parents had taken another step or two, but they had a ways to go. Come on, she said, and she and Joe started toward the water, as if there might be something to see in it that they couldn't see from where they were now. To Brody, Liz's hand felt light, as if she didn't want to trust him with her weight. He took a step, then waited for her to follow. Another, and she hesitated and then came too. He remembered a time, maybe 20 years ago, when she had ridden him piggyback. I'll make you fall, she'd laughingly warned him, but he'd turned his back and reached for her thighs, and she'd gone along with it. They were south of Carmel, cypresses black against the blue sky, a cold wind freezing Brody's ears. Were they married yet? He didn't think so. She was heavy. At the steeper parts, it took all his leg strength to brace them against falling. Point Lobos, that's where it was. On her back was a little knapsack of food, and once at the water's edge, they sat on a high rock and ate sandwiches and Oreos, bought, the Oreos, by him, because she'd said at some point that she couldn't stop eating them once she started, and he wanted to see this, evidence of a ravenous appetite. On the rough rock, she proved it. She ate 12 Oreos, 16. Then she lay back and groaned happily, and he bent over her and licked the black crumbs from the corners of her mouth. Thanks, she said now as they reached the beach. He turned back to face her. Sure. Cold, she said. You bet. He offered her his hand, and after a moment's hesitation, she took it. The kids weren't in sight. They crested the high point of the beach and stopped, looking at the ocean. It was not so dark from here, more foamy, green-gray. Two men and a young woman, a girl, walked away from them to the south. In the other direction, Lauren and Joe headed north, paralleling the waterline, Joe several feet ahead of Lauren. As Brody watched, Lauren bent to look at something in the sand, and without turning around, Joe paused too. Liz seemed about to speak and then didn't. They stood there watching their children, hands still together. This trip to the beach, Brody thought, this day in the cold air, couldn't it help them all?
It's fascinating that these details of like spinning apart, coming back together, finding hope, this is what, as you've said, you know, these are sort of the overarching themes in all of your stories. And I guess I just wonder how you're able to, at what point, how much you can continue to focus on this with all these stories that you, do you find yourself ever thinking, well, these are situations that I've dealt with so many times. How many times am I going to revisit this? I mean, do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, repetition, writing the same thing over and over again. I think, you know, that's a question that that I can imagine people having, sort of, you know, why does she keep doing these themes? For me, it's sort of a backward way of looking at it, because I think about a situation. For example, this book started with an image of a man in a hospital corridor having an encounter with a teenage boy who had rejected this man's daughter. It was 10 years before I came up with Sarah Beth and Liz as the central or a central relationship of the book. I mean, it really was just this man standing there in my mind, in a corridor of my mind for years and years. So the people lead me into the material, the characters do, and then, as we were saying earlier, the issues that we humans face, they for me seem to gather around ideas about how we treat each other and how we live inside our own minds. And I think that I have faith that I'll keep coming up with characters and situations that really require me to imagine stories that probably once again will stir up some of these same themes.
For people who aren't aware of this, and this was a big thing when The Dive from Clausen's Pier came out, you have lived some of these things in certain forms yourself. Your father, who was a very respected professor and I guess the vice provost at Stanford, became paralyzed when you were about 10, and he committed suicide when you were, I guess, 14.
13, yeah.
13 years old. So between these two books, they both together focus on this one central thing that happened in your own life. And yet you've said that with The Dive, you weren't really thinking about that when you wrote the book. And yet in this book, you said you were much more aware of it.
Yeah, when I first started writing The Dive from Clausen's Pier, and I had this young woman whose fiancé was paralyzed and she was thinking about leaving him, the fact that I had a paralyzed, important person in my life, you know, many, many, many years earlier, I don't know how to explain this, but it didn't occur to me for a long time. And I think, you know, that's the unconscious doing the work of protecting the creative impulse, because I think if I had known early on, it probably would have impeded me. But I've become a lot more, I suppose, analytical since I first started writing The Dive from Clausen's Pier, which ironically is sort of the opposite of what you might expect, has actually enabled me to be a lot freer rather than a lot more sort of organized and planful in my writing.
And so in this one, you were much more aware of, well, these are some of the things that one could be feeling at this time.
Well, you know, yeah, the idea of a person who had lost a parent to suicide, there was no way I wasn't going to, you know, I couldn't think that without having it come in a very obvious way from my own experience. I also knew, though, that Sarah Beth was not me, and that her mother, Lorelei, was very much not my father. And so it was a different dynamic, which, again, was necessary. I think I didn't want to write my story in fiction. I don't think I'll ever want to do something quite so close to my own experience in fiction. If I want to write about it, I'll write about it as memoir.
It's also interesting for people to know that you grew up in a household that was so... What was central to your house was the idea of writing and literature. Your mother was a very respected teacher of writing, also at Stanford. And in fact, Michael Cunningham, who was one of her students, wrote an incredible essay about her in 1993, before he had written The Hours, before he won the Pulitzer Prize, basically crediting Nancy, your mom, with making him the writer he is, making him decide that that's what he wanted to do. And your brother, George Packer, very renowned author, and I guess he was the guy who said that even though you appeared to have a Cadillac career as a writer, you probably didn't look like a Cadillac when you were inside the car. And because you did go to Yale, then you went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. You your first stories were published in The New Yorker. You did have this pretty amazing ride, although you were 43 before you became this huge hit bestseller. But I can only wonder what that combination of like growing up with this mother who is such a force in the writing community and the kind of other emotional turmoil that you were experiencing. You said that you and your brother have edited each other's works and your mother's in there too, but submitting this kind of thing to your mom, you know, oy.
Well, yeah. There was a time early on with my writing that I did want to show her everything in draft, but less so now. And I think it's, you know, a kind of just classic separation, really, of child from parent. I have a number of really important readers who I rely on from one draft to the next to really to help me see what it is I'm doing. I'm really lucky in that I'm in a writer's group in the Bay Area with some really terrific writers who we meet a couple times a month, and if someone is working on something, the rest of us at the appropriate time will read it and get together and talk about it. And it's those conversations even more than the sort of individual reports on, you know, well, I thought this, that, and the other thing. It's the conversations that the other people in the group have about your work that are most revealing and helpful.
You know, by the way, this is a good moment. If somebody has a question for Ann Packer, come on down to the microphones. It's great. Don't be shy. Oh, and there's a man who's going to come and ask a question. That's great. We like that. Because I think people have unfortunately sometimes pegged you as a woman's writer, but in fact there's so much that really is central to malehood in here. So step right up there, sir.
Hi, Ms. Packer.
Hi.
I'd first like to thank you for helping to prove that it is possible to simultaneously be both a Bear and a Packer fan. But I had a question. Not that many writers excel in both the novel and the short form, and I wanted to ask you if you're still writing short stories, and do you write short stories while you're working on a novel or in between or anything like that?
I love the short story form, and I will definitely, I think, always return to it. I'm pretty monogamous. As I'm writing a novel, I'm going to be pretty faithful to that novel. But in between drafts, when I, you know, take the work to my writer's group, and then inevitably have to wait a while for people to be able to read it and give me feedback, I will often work on stories during those intervals. That said, my next book is actually going to be another collection. It'll be a novella, which is a first time for me, and then four or five stories as well.
We have another, step on up there. But actually, before you formulate this question, I think for a while your career was to write blurbs for paperbacks, wasn't it, when you were in the publishing business?
Isn't that
a fun fact?
Cover copy. So, yeah, the descriptive material on the back of a paperback describing the plot or whatever.
Did it drive you insane to do that when you really wanted to be writing?
Not so much. I mean, I had a job in publishing right out of college, and for the first 12 to 18 months, I worked for the business manager, and, you know, I think I had something to do with making sure that the numbers on the order forms were correct. So when I got to start writing copy, that was a great relief.
This was the Cadillac career your brother was talking about?
Yeah, that was the scooter part of it.
Okay, another question, thanks.
Well, I guess speaking of blurb, I read something about the book that talked about the themes in it, and one of them being the redemptive power of friendship. And I guess that I am not really convinced that there was something truly redeeming necessarily about the way that the two women reconcile their friendship at the end. But I wondered whether they were sort of on the track to have kind of an interception, so to speak, such that their dynamic had been formed early on in their lives and was really rather limited. And had it not been Lauren, would something else, do you think, have come up that would have made them look at their friendships? And was there something about Liz's then reaching out to Sarah Beth at the end that was more of Liz restoring some kind of normalcy to her life and doing so with her relationship with Sarah Beth? I'd just be interested in your comments.
I think that Liz and Sarah Beth, as I read it, and I'm hesitant to go very far with this because I'm always reluctant to interpret the book for a reader. I feel like I'm finished with it, and it's your business now what you think might or might not happen to the characters later on in life. My image, as I was writing it, was that the friendship would not be the same ever again, but that there was a chance that it could be, if not as intimate in that everyday sort of way, it could be healthier. But again, the sentences in the book are pretty much the limit of where I went with imagining the story. And the rest of it is fanciful, and what you think is as legitimate as what I think.
Another question?
I'd like to ask a little bit about how you sit with your characters when you're writing it, maybe a little bit of a technical thing. But I'm wondering if you could share, when Victoria pointed out about that, the depths and layers of all the details. And do you have a particular thing that you do in terms of sitting with a character?
If I understand the question correctly, are you talking about just how I carry them around in my mind as I'm working? No, not really. The work is to be able to find the voice for each character. I mean, that's a piece of the work. And I sometimes will think of lines that a character might say, or I think of ways in which they might look at something. But for the most part, I don't really think about my writing in between actual writing sessions. Most of it happens as I'm sitting at the computer, I either successfully access a character on a given day, or I have trouble with it and try again the next day. Does that get at your question? Good.
Well, I'm going to now be really mean-spirited. It's totally against my nature, but here.
Uh-oh.
You know, well, I was really curious. People were just literally falling all over themselves with the first book, with the first novel. You were the golden girl, you know, 150,000 copies, published in 10 languages. And it's not that Knives come out for what they call, I think, it's a horrible term for it, but the sophomore book. But people are, the expectation for authors after they do one great thing, whether it's a well-reviewed, you know, book of short stories or, you know, huge success first novel, the scrutiny on the second thing has got to just be crushing, no matter anybody saying, I don't read the reviews, I don't care, I was liberated, I could write what I want. But still, it puts writers in, I think, a very difficult situation, which you were in. And the critical response to this book has not been anywhere near what the response has been to the first one. I guess my question is, you know, what do you do with that? Do you care? Do you just head down, keep going, you know?
Oh, you care a little. I mean, how can you not? Especially when the some of the reviews really took the form of attack. And, you know, that feels pretty lousy. But it's not, it's, I said to myself after I read a review of this kind, you know, when I wrote this book, it wasn't so that when I was finished, I could hand it over to 12 people I don't know and ask them to give it a grade. That's just really not what I'm about. So for me, there's that little sting of, you know, someone standing there throwing spears at you, you know, there will be a sting. It's really more a matter of what really negative reviews, especially in important newspapers or magazines, what kind of effect that might have on sales. And, you know, did I lose a large part of a potential audience because of some bad reviews? And, you know, even more sort of fundamentally, is that going to affect my ability to write another novel? Because this is how I earn a living. So for me, yeah, it really matters. But it matters in a very practical way.
Interesting. And I guess finally, I would also ask, because there's so many personal things about this book that can hit people individually, have you found that you've become, in a way, a lightning rod for people who have experienced, like for teenagers or their kids have gone through something similar, or people thinking, oh, you know, I should call up that long-lost friend? I mean, are you getting that kind of response from people at all?
A little bit. You know, it's actually early days in terms of people having read the book and then coming out to an event like today or to a reading or whatever. It's more with the publication of the paperback that once really starts to meet people who have read the book. I'm getting a lot of responses from people who have just been very compelled by it, but I haven't talked to a lot of strangers yet about it, and so I haven't really heard if it's calling up issues with friends. One person did tell me that she'd finished the book, and at the end of the book, there's a bench that figures throughout the book that Liz is painting. She does decorative furniture painting, and I don't want to give too much away, but someone said to me that she'd shown the given the book to a friend and that they'd both loved it, but one had said to the other, don't you ever give me a plaid bench.
Yeah, that bench is something that really is one of those details, and the lampshades. And that's the last question. Actually, I have to get this in. At one point, Sarah Beth is making these lampshades, and she discovers a line of paper that has the first line from famous books, and she's trying to figure out who the authors are. And I wonder, is this a totally imaginative thing on your part? Does that paper exist, and is there going to be an Ann Packer line of, you know, wrapping paper? Because you should. It's great. It's a great idea.
Well, you know, if that review did me as much damage as I'm afraid it may have, then maybe there will be a line of lampshades. The paper exists in my mind only and now in the mind of the reader.
It's a great thing. Well, Ann Packer, thank you so much for being here talking about Songs Without Words. It's been just wonderful.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
Thank you all for joining Writers on the Record with Victoria Laubin. See you in January.
The people at Maven Chronicles and at Seminary Co-op Bookstores hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast of Writers on the Record with Victoria Lautman, which will return on Sunday, January 13th, when Victoria's guest will be Michael Lowenthal, author of Charity Girl. If you'd like to be in the audience for that discussion, call 312-832-6789 to make a reservation. Admission is free. Our special thanks to everyone at Looking Glass Theater, including Executive Director Rachel Kraft and House Manager Chad Wachob. Thanks also to Chicago Magazine, including Editor Richard Babcock. Eric Arunas is the audio engineer for Writers on the Record. Steve Robinson is the executive producer. The host and producer for Writers on the Record is Victoria Lautman. Broadcasts of Writers on the Record are made possible in part by MavenChronicles.com. Let them take you somewhere. And by Seminary Co-op Bookstores, 3 Chicago bookstores with 1 world-class reputation. Phone 800-777-1456. This is 98.7 WFMT Chicago and WFMT.com, where we hope you'll stay tuned next for the BP Chicago Symphony Orchestra radio broadcast.